Thank you, and we'll have the marshal introduce the court today.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Cochran, Judge Larson, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
And good morning. Welcome to the Court of Appeals for February 11. We have three matters on our oral calendar. We are recording these proceedings as well as live streaming them, so all other recording is prohibited absent a prior court approval, which none has been sought or obtained in this proceeding. The recording, though, will be available on the court's website typically within 24 hours. But also, because of the recording, we do ask counsel to identify your name and who you represent when you begin your comments. I'll note for the record to this first matter is file A241670. It's the matter of the welfare of the child of MKB. And so, counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you may identify yourself and begin.
Good morning, Your Honor. And just to clarify, jump into my argument. Has
Yes, you may.
the
The,
clock
by
has
the way,
started. There
the
it
clock is
is.
ticking. There you go. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Good morning to the Honorable Judge Sleater, Judge Larson, Judge Cochran, counsel. We are here today on appeal posing two questions. And I represent appellants SL and RL. Our questions posed to this court are whether the district court erred as a matter of law and abused its discretion regarding a denial of a motion for adoptive placement, and whether the district court erred as a matter of law and abused its discretion regarding its denial of mandatory and permissive intervention for appellants. Our answer to both of those questions is yes, and thus we are seeking an order from this court reversing and remanding the matter on the October 2nd, 2024 order. This case is about two maternal grandparents seeking adoption of their grandchild through a motion for adoptive placement, where they established at the prima facie stage that they had a home study in progress for an adoption, and that respondent non-movement, the county, had been unreasonable in not following relative preference and not following relative notice mandates. Instead, the respondent non-movement had committed their own internal rule out without following the necessary steps required under Minnesota Statute 260 C.607 Subdivision 25, required under 260C.221 Subdivision 1C, and pursuant to this court's holdings in In Re JLG at 924 Northwest 2nd 9, pinpoint site pages 14 through 15, Minnesota Court of Appeals 2018.
Ms.
Now,
Flynn, could I ask Ms. Foshi? I think it in her, and she'll repeat this, I'm assuming orally, makes the point that the judge, well, first the judge did articulate the correct standard and presumed your client's affidavit to be true, but then makes the legal point that a judge may reference other information for context. And so, what is your response to the argument that the reference to the settlement regarding foster care license is appropriately considered for context?
thank you, Your Honor. Context and explanation is a very thin line. And in Boland, the court had established that what is contextual is first decided by what the movant sets forth in their pleadings. And so in this case, what's being set forth is that the county had not followed relative preference, set out notifications, and followed those regulations. And so they're arguing that that appellants were unable to do foster care licensure as context, allegedly, for why they didn't follow their relative mandates. However, they're overlooking the fact that this agreement that appellants had was entered into before the child was born, before they knew this child would be removed from her mother's care, and before they had the opportunity to to put in their wish to be placement. Further, Your Honor, there are options for the agency to explore variances for licensing under Section 245A16, which our clients, the appellants, would have had the option to explore had they received the relative notice required under 260C.221, subdivision
So,
2A.
variances also contemplated by the agreement itself, the idea that you could get a potential variance for a situation like this.
Is Your Honor asking?
Yeah, I'm asking whether the agreement itself actually included any language about the ability to seek variances in this type of situation.
If I may have a moment, Your Honor. Don't know that one off the top of my head.
If you don't know off the top of your head, if you could answer my question on reply, that would be great. I have sort of a separate sort of maybe one step above question, and that's you raise a lot of claims with respect to sort of procedural irregularities that happened in this case. And one of the things that I've been struggling with is how those sort of process questions relate to the bigger question of whether adoptive placement or whether a prima facie case was established at this prima facie stage to get a hearing. Could you clarify for me sort of why the lack of notice issues and things like that are actually relevant at this prima facie stage as opposed to needing to have been brought sort of as separate claims or separate issues?
You're just to clarify, Your Honor, you're asking about why those procedural requirements are relevant to a finding of whether the agency was being reasonable.
And deciding that this wasn't the correct adoptive placement, right? Because, I mean, do we have case law that says the reasonableness inquiry? I guess maybe that's my question. Do we have case law that says this reasonableness inquiry also relates to sort of these notice procedures and things like that? That it can also be the unreasonableness of procedure as well as sort of the substance. I guess that's the distinction that I'm trying to understand, the process versus the substance of whether this family is the correct adoptive placement.
Well, first of all, unfortunately, I'm not aware of any case law that speaks as to how procedure relates to the reasonableness of an adoptive placement or the reasonableness of an agency in failing to do so. But I would turn the court's attention to 260C607, where it goes into it states, at B, the prima facie level, and then at paragraph E of subdivision six. It talks about later what the court will review at the evidentiary hearing, which talks about considering relatives. And so I would rely on that portion of the statute. But also, Your Honor, our appellants put forth in their affidavit all the best interest factors that would support placement with them. That is enumerated in there and not at all assessed by the district court in its decision on whether that was or was not reasonable on the agency's behalf to fail to place KMC with them. So that would be my answer there, Your Honor.
Counsel, before you move on, I want to go back to Judge Sleater's initial question about whether the information from the settlement agreement was used by the district court to provide context or whether it actually to appellants' affidavits, or was it Did the district court actually weigh that, what was in the settlement agreement against what was set forth to make a prima facie case? In other words, did the district court use that settlement agreement solely for context?
It did not, Your Honor. It did not use it for context because it used it as a basis to argue why the agency had, or to hold why the agency had been reasonable in not placing the minor child with appellants because of this agreement. So that's where that thin line of context and explanation is. Appellants assert in their pleadings as movants at the prima facie stage that they basically that they had not gotten the relative notice, that they were not treated as relatives, that they didn't get that preference. And they're saying, A, they weren't relatives. That's what they thought. And they're saying that that preference didn't apply. And so as a result, they're saying that this letter also gave them a reason not to follow that mandate. And so it's opposing the appellants are saying there is a mandate. This is how they didn't follow it. And they're saying, well, we didn't have to. And so it's contradicting that. And that's why I would argue. And further, Your Honor, I think that it's kind of shifting the focus of what's reasonable here. There is an agreement by the respondent movements, non-movements in this case, about saying that they are relatives. And even if they weren't relatives prior, they were important friends. And there are requirements under the statute to notify them, to engage them. And all of that includes the option for them to explore any licensing, including variances, which I will get to through my reply on the letter. The county doesn't explain that. They're contradicting themselves by saying that they're contradicting the appellant's assertions by saying we didn't have to. And
would you agree though that the reason the parties entered into the settlement agreement and the underlying maltreatment determination would be appropriately considered at an evidentiary hearing if there were to be one?
Absolutely, Your Honor. That is the point of our appeal, that at the prima facie stage, that's not appropriate, that there was a rule out by the county without following proper rule out procedures pursuant to JLG and then 607, which I can cite further if the court needs. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes, thank you.
Ms. Flynn, as a matter of law, is a foster care license required in order to be considered or to have to adopt the child?
No, it is not. An adoption home study is required. And as I reviewed earlier, there are options for the county to get around any concerns. There are families all the time, Your Honor, that present themselves as family. They get a special family. The policy with the courts and right now in the state of affairs of this country is we value family. So we're going to set aside everything we can within reason to see how we can keep this child with family. And so as a result, there's variances, and the agency has not explained why they didn't go down that route. Instead, we have the appellant presenting in their moving documents that DHS has allowed the home study, which, back to your point, Your Honor, is all that is required at the adoption phase is the adoption home study. And as I referenced earlier, under 245A, the agency could have explored emergency placement while they were pursuing a variance for any exceptions to this agreement and not to get DHS licensing, which again was entered into without knowing that this child was going to be removed from their daughter's care. And I would point the court's attention back to LLP, which we cited in our brief, which holds specifically at 571 that the district court, relying on conclusive statements, which respondent actually cited in their own brief, goes contrary to the prima facie stage analysis. And in this case, at paragraph 17 of the findings of fact in the October 2nd order, the court specifically states that respondents' arguments are conclusive. So the district court's findings are in violation of LLP. And I would argue that the county's reliance on the history of the proceedings was weighed against appellant's allegations, which again, at 570 of LLP, shows that that violates the scrutiny permitted at the prima facie stage. Furthermore, Your Honor, I would argue that the respondent non-movement's pleadings did not include an affidavit. So you're holding up arguments from a memorandum of law in violation of Rule 14 of the Juvenile Protection Procedure Rules. No affidavit, only a memorandum of law. You're taking that, you're holding them as conclusive in violation of case law and using that as a reason to deny an evidentiary hearing at the prima facie stage. And again, going back to LLP, in that case, this
Ms.
court-
Ms. Flynn, I was just gonna interrupt you. Your time did run out, but you do have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You're welcome. And that reminds me, I forgot to state the obvious, what is obvious to all of us, we're appearing via Zoom technology. Those who are listening may not be quite so clear that we're staring at computer screens, but that is what we're doing. And we do ask counsel to let me know if you can't see the clock in the corner. And with that, counsel for respondent, you may identify yourself and begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jessica Boshi, Assistant St. Louis County Attorney, and I represent the respondent St. Louis County Public Health and Human Services. Today, we're requesting that the court affirm the district court's order denying the motion for adoptive placement, as the district court properly considered the moving documents from the parties, did not abuse its discretion in finding that the appellants have not alleged on a prima facie basis that St. Louis County was unreasonable for declining this adoptive placement and therefore appropriately denied an evidentiary hearing pursuant to 260C607. This morning, I hope to address the agency's legal requirements as to licensing and placement in this context, the argument of the appellants in turn, and finally, the best interests of the child, KMC. In 2022, appellant SL sought the benefit of a binding agreement with DHS to resolve her own child protection issues.
So counsel, I mean, I guess I'll ask you the same question that I asked of appellant, which is, I'll just say the thing that I struggle with this case is there do appear to be some procedural irregularities, what the cause of that was in terms of the county's information and things like that. There do seem to be some issues with the notice and things like that in that case. What case law can you point me to that helps me to understand how to evaluate potential procedural irregularities in the context of the reasonableness of the county's decision? And do we have any case law that explains to the court how we're supposed to handle those two? Because one seems like a substantive question in terms of, like, should there be an adoptive placement? And the other is more... were appellants given the due process that they were entitled to?
Thank you, Your Honor. There's no case law that I'm aware of that speaks specifically to the procedural deficiencies alleged. We do believe that LLP itself is supportive of our conclusion here today, and I can go into some of the distinguishable areas there, although to answer your question, I'm not aware of a specific case that addresses the procedural versus substantive nature that we see here today. Although I do recognize, you know, this is a fairly narrow set of facts. It's unique in many regards. So I think that also speaks to some of the difficulty there.
My next question is, the definition of relative in the statute is pretty broad. I think that you would probably agree with me. And one of the things that I struggle with in this case is whether we knew appellants were the legal grandparents or not. I think it's pretty clear from the record that
mother was living with these individuals. These individuals were certainly part of the case plan for reunification with these children. The appellants, I think the county was well aware that the child was staying with grandparents when mom was going to classes and things of that nature. And can you explain why, given the county's knowledge of that relationship between mother and appellants and the relationship between the child and appellants, why 260C211 sub 1C is obligation that the social services agency continue to try to identify potential relative placements wasn't triggered at the point where the county knew how involved these individuals were with aiding mother and getting sober?
Yes, Your Honor, I can address that. I think to your first point regarding the appellant's assertion of adoptive status, I'll speak to that first. The pleadings to the district courts primarily focused on their adoptive status, and that is the context for which the respondents' comments as to timing and clarification on the verification of adoptive status should be taken, as well as the context for appellant statements that the county should have reached out to extended family. So the timing piece of that is that we were unaware officially of that adoptive status until August 1st of 2024.
I mean, what in the statute says that you need to be officially notified of their status in order to trigger the notice provision? Because I mean, I'll just say the thing that I'm personally struggling with this case is that it does seem to me from looking at the statutes that had appellants received notice that part of what that notice includes is specifically saying that there are potential variances that they could have requested. Had they been able to request those variances, it seems that there is a procedure where they potentially could have gotten a short term or a temporary or some kind of foster care license. It seems a little bit troubling to me that there may have been procedures available to them had they received the notice. And I don't see anywhere in the statute that says a family member needs to formally inform the county to trigger the obligation for the county to be searching for them.
Yes, Your Honor. I'll speak to both their status as important friends and our consideration of that piece being that they are relatives, as well as the piece regarding licensing. Minnesota Statute 142B05 requires that a individual must not receive a child for placement in foster care or adoption unless licensed by the commissioner. And I do apologize to the court, as there was a recent renumbering of the statute from the time that I submitted my brief. I believe it was back in November. So when I referenced 245A03, that should now speak to statute 142B05. In regards to just speaking to that point and Your Honor's question in regards to variances and the settlement agreement and how that would interplay, there is no variance that can remedy an inability to apply. And that is what the settlement agreement establishes, is that appellant SL cannot even apply for licensure. Licensure has been required for placement at any time prior to an actual adoption by 142B05. Speaking to the court's points additionally as to important friends, We do not dispute their status as relative, as important friends with a significant relationship with the child. We did not do so at the district court level. We don't do that here today. Even so, the defects that the appellants alleged do not adversely impact them. In this context, appellants have largely received the benefits that they would have been afforded as relatives if they would have received the notice, which we don't contest here today at this stage. Despite not receiving formal notice, even taken as true, appellant statements to that regard do not change the placement barriers that have existed through KMNC's entire placement, and specifically as to how this did not adversely impact appellants. Appellants do not establish how, in light of the settlement agreement and legal context of licensing, they were harmed, given they could never be a placement option. There's no variance, there's no exception. But additionally, appellants from their own pleadings demonstrated that from day one, they received the benefits that the notice would have afforded them. They were involved in care and planning and case planning. Ms.
Ongoing. Boshi, you made, I'm sorry, if you didn't finish your thought or answer to Judge Larson, feel free. There was a statement towards the end of what you just said that regarding placement, and I wasn't sure I understood that. As a matter of law, isn't it true that a foster care license is not required for purposes of adoption, but simply the home study, as Ms. Flynn noted said?
That's correct, Your Honor, but I just want to note that that is a remote possibility, as at all times when the child is under the agency's placing authority, that placement must be licensed. There is no exception that would apply to the appellants. The exceptions in this matter are specifically enumerated by statute. No variance can remedy an inability to apply. A variance is not contemplated
Well,
in this.
maybe I'm not sure the distinction. If it's not required, why would a variance need to occur if it's not required for an adoption? And part of the reason I'm asking is in the context of your point, your main point about the judge's order and the affidavit being considered as true, because it was that same paragraph 17 that Ms. Flynn referred to, where the court does find that the argument regarding of the agency regarding licensing is conclusive as to the question of reasonableness of placement. So in other words, I read that to mean the judge, that was the reason the judge denied it, because as the judge is saying, as a matter of law, someone who has is not allowed to have a adoption license could never or I mean a foster care license could ever adopt. And I didn't see any law, I didn't see an explanation of that in the judge's order. And I don't think I saw it in your briefing. I understand there's a difference between pre-adoption foster care and other things like that, but wouldn't that all have to be sorted out as part of an evidentiary hearing, including perhaps an understanding of the context, since that's a good phrase that you made the argument of, a context of why that agreement was reached, what the situation, and whether it would have any relative importance as to adopting this particular child?
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't believe that an evidentiary hearing is warranted here, as it's my position that the appellants have not even established on a prima facie threshold unreasonableness as to St. Louis County declining adoptive placement in their care. And I think that is what the court's order is getting to. Of course, noting this is de novo review, the court can take its own accord and flesh out those findings further. But the outcome is correct, the analysis is correct. It is not, the question is reasonableness. And the court recognizes the reasonableness consideration, the licensing barriers, the placement barriers, how that has interplayed with the ultimate decision and reasonableness in the permanent placement of the child. It is on its face unreasonable to consider adopting a child to a home for which the child could have never resided. We cannot assess the child in their care. We can't assess their safety. There's no reasonableness on its face. So
I mean, this comes back to my
So,
question. Oh, I sorry.
is
Go ahead, Judge
can you
Cochran.
point us? Excuse me. Thank you. Can you point us to any case that has addressed kind of the argument you're making, which is that you adoptive placement is precluded unless the potential adoptive parent has a license from DHS.
Thank you, Your Honor. I
Because
cannot.
it looks like you're relying on what is now 142B05 subdivision 1, which says unless licensed by the commissioner under this chapter, an individual organization or government entity must, well, anyway, an individual must not receive a child or care, supervision, or placement in foster care or adoption. So help us understand, if there's any case law interpreting that language. I assume that's the language you're relying on.
It is, Your Honor. There's no case law that I'm aware of that would interpret that, but I think the statute is unambiguous and its plain and ordinary meaning should control that placement up until the point of adoption must be licensed. That context is significant to the ultimate question and unreasonableness in declining adoptive placement, which was the question before the court. And
And
there is.
typically, then, is that a foster care license, or just, practically, how does that happen in the usual case?
The
Or the
license.
a potential adoptive family that's interested in adopting?
If the child was placed in the home, which would be our typical scenario under Minnesota Statute 260C 611, the placement would require licensure, of course, under 142B05, up until the actual point of adoption, the court order. But under Minnesota Statute 260C 611, that requirement is now waived, but placements would have to undergo an adoption home study additionally to proceed to formal adoption. There's nothing in that statute that actually waives any sort of licensing requirement in placement. And placement is always relevant in this matter, as if the child cannot be placed through the pendency of the proceedings, the 2 years that this matter has gone on and the entirety of her life, that
so
speaks.
Is it your position then that a child cannot be adopted without previously being placed in the home?
It's not. Could the court repeat that, Your Honor? I just want to make sure I have that.
And I'm sorry if I didn't articulate the question very well, but is prior placement in the home a precondition to adoption?
It is not a legal requirement of adoption that the placement be licensed, but it cannot be said to be reasonable to place a child for a permanent placement that is in their best interest, that the child has spent no time living in the home. And that is why the court on its face finds that St. Louis County has not been unreasonable in declining this adoptive placement, as appellants have not alleged any harm from the deficiencies that they allege in their argument.
Judge Larson, I see you have.
May I ask one other question?
You certainly may, yes.
This comes back to my question about the ability to request a variance. And when I look at the notice requirements, it says that the county has an obligation to notify of the ability to request a variance. That's 211 sub 24. It says that that variance is decided by 142B10. When I go to 142B10 sub 9, it says variance for disqualified individuals. It then points to that you go to 245C.30. 245C.30 was amended before the district court made a decision which explicitly provides for child foster care variances for an individual who is seeking a foster care license who is the relative of the particular child. And so the thing that I am troubled by in this case is whether or not it would have been, whether or not the district court conflating the inability to get foster care license is in fact not quite true, because there may have been options for getting a variance in this case, and therefore the district court's premise that appellants never could have received a foster care license is a legal error, because there were potential avenues available to the appellants.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll speak to that briefly. Noting that the court citations follows a train of thought that the individual is disqualified, I would just note that that is not the appellant's status here. A disqualification under that statute holds a specific meaning, and the disqualification was overturned in light of this settlement agreement where the appellant SL agreed not to even apply for any sort of licensure for a period of 10 years time. So this is not a disqualified individual. This is an individual that cannot even apply.
This comes back to the question that I asked appellant, which is the agreement in paragraph 9 says nothing in this agreement shall limit DHS's authority to take further licensing action in accordance with 245C and all other applicable licensing laws should the rules and circumstances so warrant. And it seems to me that the record would indicate appellants have been trying to negotiate with DHS through this provision to be able to do that kind of application. And it's not clear to me why these settlement agreements would have precluded those kind of negotiations.
Thank you, Your Honor. It would be our contention that this agreement does in fact prohibit those moving forward with an application for a license. I mean, the plain language of the settlement agreement states that the appellants shall not apply for a DHS issued license, and the appellants sought the benefit of that binding agreement during the pendency of the mother's CHIPS proceedings. That agreement took place while the mother's older children were removed and just prior to the birth of KMC. Appellant SL sought the benefit of that agreement, knowing that she would not be able to apply for a license for care, and did so knowingly. And if the court would allow, I think this kind of segues into a discussion of LLP, where we can distinguish LLP from this instant matter at hand. As in LLP, the court found that the district court erred by relying on the sibling separation mandate without consideration of an exception, which was the individualized needs of the children. This is a broad exception, open to interpretation, a case-by-case basis. Here, no exception applies. A variance cannot be applied for because the appellants cannot legally submit an application. And there is the exceptions to this rule are all enumerated by statute. They are not open to interpretation. They are clearly laid out by statute. And the appellants do not fit any enumerated exception. So there was not this lack of consideration of exceptions that could have applied. None could apply. The rule stands that licensing, this was a conclusive determination as to licensing, and is different from LLP, because in LLP, there was an exception that was ignored, that the court wrongfully relied on the mandate without considering the exception.
Slater, can I ask one?
You certainly may, Judge Cochran.
So in reaching its conclusion then, did the court weigh the settlement agreement against the move-ins documents?
No, Your Honor.
And if not, why not? Why is it on the line? Why, in your view, did the district court look at the settlement agreement simply to provide context rather than weighing it versus against the move-ins affidavit?
Thank you, Your Honor. The court did not weigh the evidence in this matter, as the court did not weigh the context against the truthfulness of appellant's statement. Against the context provided or the procedural history, the appellant's statements, the court recognized the mandate, it accepted the appellant's statements as true, and the truthfulness was not contradicted by the settlement agreement. It just provided this background information of legal context for which applied by appellant's own statements by raising the issue through their moving documents of licensing issues and a settlement agreement through their affidavit. Because the court did not question the truthfulness of appellant's statements, it did not weigh the evidence here. And that is an additional distinction from LLP, where in LLP, the court found that the court abused its discretion by weighing the evidence the court formulated weighing the evidence as the court considering the conduct of the agency in its assessment of a prospective adoptive placement against the appellant's scrutiny of that same placement. So the evidence, the truthfulness of appellant statements in LLP was weighed against the conduct of the agency in assessing that placement. So here we have a different circumstance where the truthfulness of those statements was not weighed against appellant statements. Appellant statements were taken as true, but the deficiencies alleged did not produce any harm. In the context of an unlicensable placement, it was not unreasonable for the court to decline that ultimate adoptive placement on its face. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Foshi. And now, counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes, and I see it on the clock. You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I would like to underscore what Judge Larson pointed out in her question, that again, the agreement that Appellant SL entered into with DHS at their paragraph 9 states that nothing shall limit DHS's authority to take further licensing action in accordance with the statutes, which Judge Larson mentioned at 245A and 245C. In this case, there's nothing offered from the county as to what they're doing, what they did to explore that. In fact, they are providing the contradiction that they didn't need to explore that. And when we're talking about procedure.
But here we have a settlement agreement where she agreed not to seek licensure for 10 years, correct? That's what the settlement, sorry, I'm gonna sneeze. excuse me. So I think you know, even if the statutes may provide for a variance in circumstances, the settlement agreement still binds appellant, correct?
It does, Your Honor, but it includes that portion where DHS can take further action, and the agency has not offered anything explaining why they didn't under that agreement. Further, Your Honor, I would say that the procedure is relevant to reasonableness. And to Judge Larson's question, I would quote Matter of the Welfare of the Child of CF, which is unpublished, but it's at A19-2099, 2020 WL443317 at 7, Minnesota Court of Appeals, August 3rd, 2020. There, the Court of Appeals defined reasonableness or referenced the definition of reasonableness is not guided by reason, irrational, capricious, or whether an agency actually acted unreasonably is fact-driven and will depend on the unique circumstances of each case. Specifically, that court referenced TDS and RRB. Determining whether a county's decision was not guided by reason can be assessed by analyzing whether the agency's rationale for its action was legally sufficient. I'm going to stop there and point out that it wasn't. It did not follow the protocol of filing a motion and seeking a formal finding from the district court ruling out appellants as an adoptive placement option for this child. And whether that legally sufficient rationale has a factual basis in the record is the second part that the matter of the welfare of the child of CF quotes. And so on that, again, referencing the portions in the statute requiring the rule out that the court in JLG specifically said that there must be a rule out in order to exclude that family. And in this case, the county performed that rule out without any of those procedures. It was not legally sufficient, and thereby it was unreasonable to not consider appellants at the stage when they sought adoptive placement. Further,
so counsel, to that point, whether it was unreasonable not to consider appellants, can you address respondent's argument based on 142B05 subdivision 1-2? Basically that it's not, it would be unreasonable to place a child in for adoption if there hadn't been prior placement, and that there's a licensing barrier to prior placement, if I'm summarizing that accurately.
So Your Honor is stating that, could you rephrase that, Your Honor?
Well, could you just address respondent's argument that the district court wasn't unreasonable in concluding that licensing was a barrier to placement?
They're unreasonable, back to the same case law I just reviewed, Your Honor, because it wasn't legally sufficient. There is no requirement, as Justice Slater has, the Honorable Judge Slater has mentioned, for there to be foster care licensure prior to adoptive placement. And in this case, Ms. Foshi just commented that the child could have never been placed with appellants without anything on the record or in their affidavit explaining that through the course of a variance in applying consistently with the DHS agreement that appellant had. I believe that concludes my time. So we ask that the court reverse and remand the October 2nd order.
Very well. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions this morning, as well as your briefing. We will take the matter under advisement under the expedited child protection timeline that we use. You each have a good day. Thank you.
Thank you.